my safer investments, my bonds. And then the rest, I'm going to split. I'm going to split.
John's laughing because I just pointed at my shirt. I'm wearing my Bonds Are for Losers shirt. And just as another disclaimer, I don't actually think bonds are for losers. I just think it's a funny shirt.
Welcome to the Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to Mostly Money. I'm your host, Preet Banerjee. And on the show today, I've got John Robertson, who's going to talk to us about how easy it can be to invest yourself and whether or not that is right for you, among some other topics that we'll get into, no doubt. Now, before we go on to the interview with John, I would like to give out a shout out to the regular listeners who are kind enough to leave ratings and reviews on iTunes. So shout outs this week to, and I always have trouble pronouncing these because I think sometimes people just bang at the keyboard because they don't actually have a username. So there's MJDYC, Charles Millette, Malarkis, Amanda from Ottawa, who particularly liked the estate planning episode with Sandra Foster, ME62462, User Something, and Cuckoomon, who sometimes listens to episodes multiple times. Thank you all for being listeners and for leaving your reviews, and thank you to everyone who leaves either a rating or a review. And just a reminder, I do read them all, and they are very much appreciated. And now, without further ado, let's get on to today's guest. John Robertson is a scientist, writer, investor, teacher, and all-around nice guy. He specializes in explaining complex topics, scientific or financial, for regular people. He has a PhD from the University of Western Ontario in medical biophysics and spends his days as a science writer and editor for the Techna Institute in Toronto. Personal finance and investing have long been personal passions for John. He's been an active part of the Canadian personal finance community for over 7 years, blogging at Blessed by the Potato, creating spreadsheets and how-to guides, amongst other commentary and analyses. In 2011, he started Robertson Investment Services to help investors move away from relying on commission sales staff to planning investing on their own. Those experiences helped identify the need for the material that would become The Value of Simple, and provided a venue to test and refine the explanations and tools that form the book. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me out, Preet.
Always a pleasure to spend time with you. And I think it's very timely that we talk. The main thing that we're going to talk about is the second edition of your book, The Value of Simple. And I think it's much more important, more than ever, because there's so much noise out there. The world just seems like it's more complex. And part of that might just be the fire hose of information sources that are out there. Some of it's right. A lot of it is wrong. And people need to cut through the noise, and they don't know how to do that. With the backdrop of, you know, people complaining about high costs, lack of value that they're getting from the financial services, people sometimes don't know where to turn, and they are looking for guidance. And that's kind of the promise of the book, is giving them some guidance, helping them understand if there are better ways maybe to handle their investments. Now, before we get too much into the book, as you know, because I'm presuming you're a regular listener of this podcast, I like to ask all my guests about them, about themselves, and what led them to doing what they are ultimately doing right now. So let's go back, sort of like a brief, this is your life, John, back to, let's say, undergrad, university. What did you study, and walk us through quickly how you went from there to where you are today?
Well, I guess if we're going all the way back to undergrad, then we should include a quick sidebar about before undergrad, which is when I'm applying.
Sure.
And so I was not sure what I wanted to do with my life as a kid graduating high school, which I'm sure is a very common experience. So I applied to a number of different programs, and I actually applied to U of T twice. I applied to the biochemistry stream because I thought biochemistry sounded like a cool thing to do for science. Turns out I hated biochemistry, but I did enjoy science. But I thought, you know, maybe I'd be a scientist, maybe go on to become a physician or do research or something. But at that time, it was pretty nebulous. But I also enjoyed finances and business, so I also applied to the BCom program at U of T.
Oh, interesting.
And then when my acceptance letters came around, I got into both. So I accepted the BCom version of the application. And as it turns out, I didn't actually need to apply to both because you can change your major as soon as you register.
Right.
But I applied within the BCom program to U of T, and it was in the summer right before first year when I'm picking my courses, and I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, I've got to take this course in commerce and this course in accounting, and I've got to take some calculus, but I don't want to lose my science edge, especially because it's going to be a lot harder if I graduate with a commerce degree to go back and sort of pick up science if I want to do science on the side. So I was starting to fill my electives card with science stuff, so biology and physics, and turns out that I was overloaded on courses and I had to cut something back. And as I'm sitting there making the difficult decision of, you know, which one do I want to cut, I decide to actually cut the commerce courses and then completely change my major at that moment to biophysics.
All right. So you're very indecisive is what you're saying.
I am. I'm very indecisive, very eclectic, lots of different interests. But yeah, so I had an interest in finance and business sort of all along, but not quite enough to end up making it my degree.
Okay, so you do your undergrad, you've now switched into the science focus, then presumably you do your master's. Where'd you go for that?
Yeah, so then I went to the University of Western Ontario. I did a master's degree in medical biophysics and then re-enrolled almost immediately for a PhD degree.
And what was your dissertation?
My dissertation, I can't believe I can't remember it considering how big of a, I don't remember the precise title, but it was the effect of magnetic fields on neuromodulation.
Oh, right. And what did you find? Just kidding. There's no way I could understand that. So, okay. So you get your PhD and then what happens? How easy was it to, get a job after completing your PhD?
It took not too terribly long. As I was in the process of finishing my PhD, there was another investigator within the Lawson Research Institute where I was working who was looking for a short-term postdoc. So I did a six-month postdoc with him right after graduating, like the day after my thesis was done. I walked into his lab and started doing very related work and then started shopping around for jobs. And it was actually on the night that I defended my PhD that my wife found out that she was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And then that led to a bit of soul searching and decided that I did not want to pursue the academic path in research, which was further helped by the fact that I did not have a particularly high number of high impact publications. So it would be a very challenging road if I did try to go down that. So I started searching around for other jobs, found this job posting that I'm still currently at with University Health Network, which was to be a science communicator, science writer, grant writer for the Tekna Institute.
Okay, so you've got a lot of experience writing, and I'm imagining that part of that skill set is distilling complex concepts to make them understandable for people like me.
That's exactly what I try to do in a big part of my job is to do that.
Okay. All right, so this has set you up well to be an educator. And where did you develop this passion for personal finance?
That's sort of been building slowly over time. Like I've always had a debt aversion and tried to make it through my studies on the stipend that I got, as well as a few small gifts from my family and scholarships and that sort of thing. So I didn't go into debt to finish any of my degrees. And also just trying to help other people understand their money, because a lot of this sort of came fairly naturally to me. I mean, I was 12 when my dad hauled me into the bank and was like, all right, we're going to set up a GIC so that you can earn more interest than you are in your regular savings account. And so I also have to credit my dad a lot with, you know, first off providing me with the interest and also providing me with my first education in terms of how this would come. But trying to explain it to other people, I realized that it's kind of hard. It's really hard. And you have to work at it and try different explanations. And so I had a blog forever and would just throw up thoughts, throw up rants. And that became more and more focused on personal finance. I got more and more into it. And now the blog is almost exclusively personal finance and has been for a number of years.
You know, what's interesting is there's a real parallel between yourself and I in that my first real job was at McDonald's. I was 15 when I got that job. And my very first paycheck, as soon as I got that, my dad marched me to the bank and he said, you pick the mutual fund you're going to invest in, and you're going to put, I think it was $25 every 2 weeks, something like that. And I didn't know the first thing about investing. And he said, yeah, you should pick. So back then I just looked in the newspaper, looked at all the mutual fund tables, found the one that did the best last year. It was the Altamira Resource Fund returned 108% the prior year. So I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. Wouldn't mind doubling my money every year. So that's what I put my money into. Funny enough, years later, when I was working as a stockbroker, they're always branch visits from fund managers, and the fund manager of that fund came in one day and I told him that story. Probably didn't care, but anyways, let's circle back to you. So you became a blogger and you have a lot of people coming to you asking for advice about personal finance and investing.
Yeah, more or less willingly. Sometimes I would, you know, with particularly with friends, I'd see that they weren't investing or they weren't interested, and I'd be like, you should do something about this. And then sort of start the conversation, and you know, a little awkward sometimes. It's not always easy to get someone who's not interested, but I try.
It is tough, isn't it? Right. Okay. So let's talk about your book, The Value of Simple. So what is the promise of the book to the reader? Who's the book for? What are they going to get out of it?
So the book is for people who have a very common problem here in Canada, which is that they want to get their money invested for the long term and they don't know where to go to do that. And so the book is going to walk them through, first off, the bit of a trade-off between fees and value. And, you know, the sort of shorthand conclusion is that Canada has some of the highest mutual fund fees in the world, and people don't tend to get a lot of value for that. If they go into a local bank branch and they get set up with a mutual fund, as you might have done as a kid, that mutual fund included a fee for advice. And mm-hmm. they're not getting good advice along with it. So if you're not getting good advice, you might as well cut that part out, cut your fees as much as possible, invest in a very easy to understand, very easy to manage portfolio of index funds. And then the book shows you how to do that in a couple of different ways, how to actually get your money invested.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You hear a lot about supply chains these days, because if the past couple years have taught us anything, it's that an efficient, well-managed supply chain is absolutely critical to keeping businesses successful and consumers happy. I'm Will Haywood, and I host a podcast called All Business, No Boundaries, where we talk about supply chains, how they work, what happens when they don't, and the innovations that are redefining what's possible in the world of logistics. Join me for insightful interviews with thought leaders and industry experts. We discuss how optimizing supply chains can break down the barriers that are holding businesses back. That's All Business, No Boundaries by DHL Supply Chain. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, okay, so let's take it back a step, because you make it sound so simple. Well, the problem is clear, you know. Fees are high, value is suspect in many cases. So how do you quantify that? How do you make that resonate with people? Because for years, you know, one of the reasons that this situation continues today is because people haven't really realized exactly what the trade-offs are that they're making and all their different options that they have out there. So have you done any number crunching to sort of quantify, well, here's why this is so important? It's not just saying, oh, well, fees are high and value is suspect. What does that mean to the average person? How do you get them motivated to do something different?
Well, there's two things that you have to motivate them to do. And one is, as you say, motivate them to understand that fees are important. And the really quick way to do that is to look at how those fees compound over time. And compared to what you could have if you invested in a very low fee way, if you're investing over 30, 35 years, that extra 2 and a bit percent that you're paying versus what you could in a lower cost index fund is taking away half of your total potential investment value over that long time period. Because even though the fees sound small, because we talk about them in percentages, they happen every year. They're taken off every year, and they grow and they grow and they grow. The loss in your value grows and grows and grows along with the growth in your funds. And so that really takes a big bite. If you imagine having half of what you could potentially have in retirement, I mean, that really affects how much security you're going to have in retirement and how much you're going to be able to spend then, or conversely, how much you have to save now.
Are you familiar with the concept of the angel's share?
Yes, I heard that from you.
Right. So this is something, I think it's a great analogy to use for people, especially if they're whiskey drinkers. So, you know, what's interesting is that, over time, as I've started to drink more and more whiskey on the podcast, today's an exception because I'm going on a bender tonight. So I need to save up. But I've been talking about the different whiskeys, and when guests come on, I give them the choice from the whiskey cabin, you know, which ones do you want to drink? And we talk about it for, you know, a few minutes, then we go on to the podcast.
It's an audio podcast, but it's a very big whiskey cabin.
It's very tempting. It's just sitting there looking at me. Maybe I will have some whiskey now. Anyways, so with, as I was sort of alluding to, is the funny part is that the comments that I'm getting now on the podcast, on iTunes, when people are leaving reviews and stuff, or when they're sending me emails, are that they actually like the whiskey content almost as much, if not more, than the financial content. So I think that's a compliment. But in any case, the analogy of what the Angel share is and the seemingly innocuous 2% charges, 3% charges, whatever, can be explained using the Angel share. So when a whiskey is being aged, they put it into a barrel and the wood is porous and there's an exchange between the outside environment and the inside environment. There's a certain amount of evaporation. And the Angel share is basically when you take a barrel of whiskey and you measure how much liquid is in there and then you compare it to a year later, about 2% gets lost to the outside environment. And so they call that the Angel share. Which I don't know if that's a good thing. I mean, it's a nice spin on it, but you're losing, you know, the spirit that's in the whiskey cask. Now, over time, if you age that for 10, 15, 20 years, that 2% really adds up, or I guess takes away over time, how much whiskey is in that barrel. And so if you had a 25-year aged whiskey, the amount of spirit that's in there is going to be, I don't know, something like 50%, something like that, compared to what was put in the beginning. And it's the same thing with your investment costs. That seemingly innocuous few percent per year over time really adds up. So think about it this way. Would you rather have a full barrel of 25-year-old whiskey or half a barrel? Well, of course, you'd want the full barrel. And so the lower you can reduce the Angel share or the costs, then the more the potential could be. But of course, costs aren't the only variable to consider. So let's take a look at this point. Because one of the attractions for a lot of people to going the do-it-yourself route is sometimes people are just really passionate about investing. They just want to do things themselves. That's fine. But then there are people who are attracted specifically because the costs are lower if they're to manage things themselves. What is your advice to people who are focused on costs?
Well, if you're focused on costs, that can actually really work well for you because a lot of the research that we've seen is that the more you try to get too involved in your investing portfolio and try to make active decisions, try to mess around with things, or just even track it and see those daily fluctuations and try to keep ahead of the financial news, you tend to do worse. So if you can set yourself up in a very passive way with a good portfolio at the beginning and then just stick to it and then not pay very much attention to it, you might actually come out better than someone who does have a ton of passion for it but keeps making behavioral mistakes. But those people still need to figure out how to do it. And that's where I found that there was a lot of missing information in literature. Like you can find tons of books, not all of them are fantastic, but tons of books on you need to save your money and not go into debt.
Right. Which are the bad ones?
Yeah.
I'm kidding. one of the challenges that I hear from people is they've been hearing all, you know, reading blogs, seeing various newspaper articles, people on TV saying that, yes, there is an advantage to doing it yourself and reducing costs if you are the right type of person to do that. What is the biggest hurdle you find for people to actually take the first step? Because what I found is, like with many things, just doing it and getting over that initial inertia is usually the hardest thing. It's like going to the gym. The hardest part about going to the gym on a regular basis is getting to the gym. Once you're there, you're going to work out. And even if you don't have a perfect workout, it's a lot better than not going to the gym. And when it comes to whether it's seeing a financial advisor, seeking out financial advice, or doing it yourself, or learning about investing, it's just that first step is the hardest part. For the people who take your course, do you have a sense of how much easier it is than they thought it would be after they take the course, or is it very complex and daunting?
Well, the problem is have the people who don't end up investing come back and tell me I took the course and I didn't end up investing. But I got a lot of people that do. And yeah, that confidence to get started, that inertia to get started, and also the confidence, because buying an investment, buying an ETF is a lot different than buying a book on Amazon. And the companies that sell the funds, with the exception of a few that are working towards making it easier, don't seem to have a ton of interest in making it really easy for people to buy. They seem more interested, and this may be because it's a regulated product, in covering their butts. So they'll sell it to you, but they'll do it in a very structured way that they've been doing for hundreds of years, perhaps just digitized versions of paper forms that they might have used on the floor of the stock exchange, etc. So this is not a super easy thing to grasp if you're just coming into it cold. But then once you see someone walk you through it, you're like, oh, that's not actually so bad. It's just different from buying a book, but it's not like fundamentally different. I'm still buying a thing with money.
Right.
And then they sort of get it, and they can start to open an account and move forward.
Let's talk about the right type of person. Like there's some people believe that they don't have enough money to start investing. Some people believe that they don't have the financial literacy to start investing on their own. What are your thoughts on that? For people who are listening and saying, oh, that's not for me. I'm not an investor. I can't keep on top of the markets or whatever. There's various reasons that people come up with, but what do you need? What is the basic minimum that you need to get started? I don't mean minimum in terms of amount of money. I mean like all the variables.
Yeah. So you don't actually need very much. Tons and tons of people would be pretty well suited to investing their money mostly on their own. And I say mostly because there's a lot of services out there now these days called robo-advisors or Tangerine, which used to exist. And I'll pause for Preet to give his
Disclosure. Yes. So as a point of disclosure, I have done consulting work for various financial services, not with also including Tangerine, which I've had a relationship with them for years, generating financial literacy content. However, there's no requirement for me to shill any products or anything like that. So we can say anything we want.
Yeah. All right. I'm also a member of certain referral programs for these, but otherwise don't receive money. So I'm a member of a referral program for a couple of robo-advisors, for Tangerine and for Questrade. But you can make it quite easy to invest with something like Tangerine or some of the robo-advisors. Like, you basically just have to get set up in the beginning to say what you want your money invested in, and then essentially throw money at them and they'll get it invested for you. So you don't need to have a ton of interest or a ton of time to do it, except for a little bit of time to learn about what you're getting into. You don't need to have a ton of money. You can open an account with just like $100 at Tangerine, or a few thousand, like single digit thousand.
So you don't have to be like an aspiring Wall Street douchebag.
Absolutely not.
Okay. Yeah.
You don't need a ton of math comfort. Like, you're going to have to do some multiplication and use percentages. That's about the extent of the math. Mm-hmm. Anything else is just like repeating it. Like, if you're talking about exponential growth and you're like, oh, I haven't done exponents in a while. You don't have to use exponents. You can just repeat multiplication and percentages.
Well, give me an example. So give me an example of a typical equation that someone would need to figure out. Like, we're talking like, I have $1,000, I need to buy X number of units kind of thing. Is that, yeah, that basically it?
That's basically it. So it's, I have, you know, $5,000 and I want to invest in four things to become properly diversified. And I have to decide, okay, how much am I going to put into each of the four things? So first I come up with what's called my asset allocation. How much risk am I willing to take? If I'm willing to take a certain amount of risk, then that's going to lead me to putting a certain amount, a certain percentage. So let's say I'm, you know, fairly moderately risk accepting for my age, and I use a rough rule of thumb like you might find in the book and say, okay, I'm going to put 30% of whatever I have into my safer investments, my bonds. And then the rest I'm going to split. I'm going to split.
John's laughing because I just pointed at my shirt. I'm wearing my Bonds Are for Losers shirt. And just as another disclaimer, I don't actually think Bonds Are for Losers. I just think it's a funny shirt.
Yeah, and it is a legitimately funny shirt. So then you're going to put the rest into some other mix of other things, which will be your equities, your growth stuff. And you'll probably split that up into Canadian and US and international funds. And so then that's all you have to do is multiply the amount you have $5,000 by that each of those percentages to find out how many dollars are going into each of those things. And then depending on what you're using, that might be the extent of your math. You might then just say, okay, I've got this many dollars and I'm going to put them into this fund. And then that's it, because the fund will let you buy however many partial units you need to invest that amount of money. Or if you're buying an ETF, you need to do one more division step to look at the current price of the ETF, the amount you want to invest, and then turn that into units.
Okay. So not
super complicated math.
Yeah. So in terms of the math, yeah, very simple multiplication and division. Now, so you talked about asset allocation and whatnot. So there are some listeners who are like, asset allocation, I know that stuff already. But there's always a lot of listeners who that's going to be somewhat of a foreign term. So for people who are newer to investing, a lot of what you said is going to sound kind of intimidating. All right, he said so much in Canadian, so much in US and diversification and all this stuff. So walk us through what goes into an investment portfolio. Like, keep it simple.
Yeah. So in an investment portfolio, you're going to try to buy things that you expect are going to be worth more in the future, are going to produce some sort of income for you. So in other words, you're going to take your money, invest it so that you have more money in the future. And we're going to use a lot of terms in investing. I don't know if we'll use them on the podcast that sound like gambling. Investing.
Always bet on black.
Exactly. Or this is not a good bet, or, based on the riskiness of this. So investing sounds a bit like gambling because we talk about bets sometimes. It's not really a bet, but we'll use that as a shorthand or sort of jargon in the investing world. We talk about risk. We talk about uncertainty. These are all things that are common to gambling. And a lot of the math that we use in investing comes from the field of games of chance. Mm-hmm. But investing is not gambling because we expect to make money if we keep doing it for the long term. But there's the uncertainty and we may lose money, particularly in the short term. Gambling, we may make money in the short term, but if we keep doing it for the long term, we expect we're probably going to lose money.
Right. The house always wins.
Yes.
Right. When you go to Vegas. But the stock market's a little bit different as long as you don't get crazy. Right. Yeah. Like if you have a disciplined investment strategy, then chances are there's going to be volatility in the interim. But if you stick to your plan and it's a proper, prudently constructed portfolio, that's kind of the trade-off. Right. Like if it just went in a straight line up, then everyone would just arbitrarily choose a higher rate of return. And of course, it doesn't work that way, right? Yeah. So the trade-off is if you want a higher rate of return, the trade-off is short-term volatility is kind of what you're trading off, right?
Yeah. And also, you don't know how well different types of investments are going to do. So a main core of what you're going to be investing in is buying partial ownership of companies. Mm-hmm. So people are familiar with companies. They make things and sell things and make money. So you go to Tim Hortons, you buy your coffee, you go into your car, which was made by a car company, which made money selling you the car. You fill it with gas from a company that pulled oil out of the ground, refined it into gas, and then sold it to you at a markup, and they made money. And so when you own a portion of the company, you get a portion of those profits to sort of put it as a high level summary here. The problem is not all companies do well all the time. So you can't just pick one or two companies and hope that that's going to form the basis of your investments for the future, because they may go bankrupt. You know, we saw Sears go bankrupt earlier this year. There'll be another company that goes bankrupt next year. Don't know which one yet, but you know that some of them will. But if you invest in enough, then overall, most companies on average are going to start to make money for you, and your investment will start to make money for you. And that's diversification. So you, instead of trying to pick one or two winners, you diversify across a whole bunch of them. And then you diversify not just across the companies in your own country, but companies across the world. So you invest in Canadian companies, US-based companies, and companies in the rest of the world. And they, when we construct mutual funds or funds, these buy up a whole bunch of companies for you so that you just have to buy the one mutual fund, and then it's going to invest in all those other companies on your behalf. And then there's also the bond side, which are like loaning money to someone and then expecting to get interest back. And it's a lot safer because you have a set rate of return. It's less likely that even in bankruptcy, the bond will be completely worthless, et cetera, et cetera. And then you decide, well, how much risk and volatility am I willing to accept? Because the bonds are going to be less risky and less volatile. Again, not zero risk, not zero volatility. And that's another hard thing to understand, is that there's always going to be some measure of risk in everything you do. I mean, crossing the street involves risk. Taking a drive to the grocery store involves risk. It's just that because it's an everyday experience, we don't think about it as much. When it comes to our money, the risk is a lot more visible.
So one of the overarching things that people need to figure out is where they sort of sit on that risk spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. So you could be very aggressive and hope for a high potential rate of return, and the trade-off is that you're going to see a lot of volatility or there's going to be a lot of risk. On the other end of the spectrum, maybe you don't like to see their portfolio fluctuating at all, in which case maybe you get a GIC, which is guaranteed low return, but you're guaranteed to get that low return. And then between these two ends of the spectrum, you can basically choose where you want to be. So it's not a binary decision where it's you're all in or not. You can sort of tweak your portfolio so that it's somewhat tailored to your comfort and appetite and requirement or need for risk.
Absolutely. And then that also will come with other trade-offs. So if you're expecting that your portfolio is going to give you a very low return because you're investing in a very low risk way, you need some sort of return to get the amount of money that you're going to need for your financial goals, like retirement. So if you're investing in a very low risk way, the trade-off for that might be that you have to have a higher savings rate.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think maybe a lot of people just hearing that is like, oh, this might be a light bulb moment where, okay, maybe if I just save more, I can take less risk and be more comfortable with investing. So investing doesn't have to be scary, does it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the problem is that risk and uncertainty and volatility, these are all scary words and scary concepts. It doesn't have to be super scary, or you can just accept that it's scary and the rest of the world is scary too. You're just used to it and you're just not used to this level of scary.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, again, this inertia. So a lot of people, especially younger generations, I think are more comfortable interacting online. There's a lot of information online. There's more services that are now available online. You mentioned what are called robo-advisors. So can you quickly define what a robo-advisor is?
So a robo-advisor is a complete misnomer because they're not robots and they're not advisors. Mm-hmm. So what a robo-advisor is really like an online portfolio manager. So you're going to go to a robo-advisor and they're going to set you up with an investment portfolio. They'll do a quick risk assessment to try to figure out what sort of portfolio is going to be appropriate for you. And then you're going to basically send them money and they'll set up a portfolio for you to invest. And they'll create a TFSA or RSP, which we haven't defined yet, and that's okay. We'll get to it, or and if not, you can look it up online. And they'll buy exchange-traded funds, which are a form of mutual fund, which have all of these investments within the bonds and the stocks from all over the world. And they'll manage all of that complexity for you, picking which ETFs to buy, making sure that it stays within the balance that you first decided on, and keeping it within your TFSA or RSP and doing any reporting to the government that needs to happen for that. Little asterisk footnote about non-registered accounts will have reporting requirements in your end too, but we'll ignore that for now. And so you'll just, for very reasonable cost, because they're not bundling a bunch of other services or physical office locations in there, for a very reasonable cost, you can get your money invested without having to worry too much about the details on the day-to-day basis.
So in terms of doing it yourself using a robo-advisor, quote-unquote robo-advisor, online portfolio management service, it's kind of like the equivalent of taking a BuzzFeed quiz. You answer a few questions and it'll tell you what kind of luncheon meat would I be, right? Kind of, that's basically as hard as it is, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
And they are one of the ones that are interested in making the experience for the user very simple and very easy to get signed up and stay with them.
If you were a luncheon meat, what luncheon meat would you be?
Oh, I don't know. It's like, what qualities of a luncheon meat go into a person?
We've gone down a tangent. I shouldn't have gone down. All right, let's go back on track here. okay, so we have robo-advisors. And when it comes to doing it yourself, if you don't want to delegate everything to a robo-advisor, because a robo-advisor is, you said, a reasonable cost, but you could go lower cost because, again, going back to people who are very much focused on rock bottom cost, like there are some people who are just, I need a 0.07% at most total cost on my portfolio. And they'll do anything they can to lower their costs overall. So the way to do that is to handle everything themselves. So what are they looking at?
So there's an intermediate step, which is going to be the TDE series, but they're really looking at exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. And you've probably heard this acronym a lot, and it's because they're very, very popular these days, and lots of people like to talk about them because they are the cheapest way to get investing, and because the robo-advisors talk about them too, because they invest in ETFs on your behalf. Mm-hmm. So ETFs, not all of them are super cheap, not all of them are index funds, but there are going to be index fund ETFs that are very, very cheap, and that's going to be the cheapest possible way to invest, is to use those. But in order to get them, you have to set yourself up with a discount brokerage account. And then you have to go to the stock exchange, and I don't mean physically, within the discount brokerage, you buy an exchange-traded fund over the stock exchange, which means you have to enter an order just like you would for a stock, which means there's bid prices and ask prices. You have to round down to the nearest number of units so that you buy and hold units, because you can't just put in an arbitrary dollar amount. You can only buy even quantized units, so you have to buy in that portion. So if an ETF is trading at $25, you have to buy in multiples of $25.
Right.
And then the orders only go through while the market's open, and the price changes almost second by second. And so it's a little bit more intimidating to put an order in that way. But for that little bit of extra work, you can save a fair bit of costs.
Right. Let me throw out an analogy for you and see if this makes sense. So when we come to the various ways that people can invest, so you've got real do-it-yourself where you figure out your portfolio, the components, maybe you buy individual stocks, bonds, whatever, but you do everything yourself. You're executing trades and whatnot, and that can be the lowest cost. And that's kind of like going to the grocery store and getting whole foods that you then take home. You cut up, you clean, you whatever, you cook them, and you make a meal out of the ingredients that you buy. Next, you've got things like, say, a robo-advisory service. And this is like getting a meal kit that is delivered to you, and you just put things together. And then the next tier up might be, all right, Uber Eats, where you get a hot prepared meal delivered right to you and you eat it right away. Or you can go out to a restaurant and that'd be like a full service advisor. Is that kind of like an analogy when it comes to all the different investing options out there?
Yeah, that's a pretty good one, because you're looking at producing more and more work to save more and more money.
Right. And so there's a spectrum where people lie on this continuum as well. There are people for various reasons, maybe they've got lots of money and not a little time, and they're willing to say, well, you know what? I don't mind spending more than maybe I should at a full-service fancy restaurant, because I just don't want the hassle, right? And yep. I don't need to be efficient with my money. And maybe they are, right? But, you know, they would go to the high-end restaurant, Michelin-starred, whatever, and they could eat that every single night. And that's fine, as long as they know what they're signing up for. And then there are people who will cook their own meals every single day. They'll get one chicken in the last 20 days or whatever. And there's a lot of people in between. Like, I mean, there are times when I order Uber Eats and I feel super lazy for doing that. But there's a spectrum, right? So
I have the same thing with cantaloupe. I tend to go toward the cantaloupe that they've already got pre-cut up into cubes.
Right.
Because just that extra step of cutting the cantaloupe and shelling, taking the seeds out in the middle,
sure,
then cutting off the outside and cutting it up into cubes myself, like just that extra couple of minutes at home, I just don't end up doing it. I'm like, oh, I'll have the cantaloupe tomorrow.
Right.
And then like a week later, I've got a rotten cantaloupe on my counter. Whereas if I actually spend a little bit more money for the cantaloupe that's cut up, I actually eat the cantaloupe. And so for me, spending that little bit of extra money to get the prepared one is value, because then I actually end up eating the cantaloupe versus
right
go to waste.
You know what? I think there's something to this analogy. I think you should, if you're looking for inspiration for a blog post, do a comparison of the different ways you can get food in your belly to all the different types of investment options or advice options you have out there. Anyways, all right. So let's go back to our newbie investor or someone who's thinking about doing it themselves. And they buy your book. Walk us through the things that they're going to learn. So we talked a little bit about the barriers to entry. So you don't need a lot of money.
Yep.
You can choose your asset allocation. That's an important concept, which I'm sure you talk about at length in the book.
Yeah. And give a few like just rough rules of thumb, because asset allocation can get really complicated if you want it to, because there's no right answer. Mm-hmm. And so if you keep looking, you'll find more and more articles talking about more and more factors. But at the end of the day, you just need to get your investments invested somewhat rationally. And so a good rule of thumb is probably worth more than a whole second book on asset allocation and factors.
Yeah. And I would also add to that, and I would say when you're just starting out, and if you're not starting with a large amount of money, all these decisions are pretty trivial in terms of the impact on the variability of how much you're going to have at the end of 1 year. The most important factor when you're just starting out is your savings rate, right? Okay, so investing doesn't have to be intimidating. In the book, they're going to learn about portfolio construction, right? Asset allocation, time horizon, how that constrains the amount of risk that you might be willing to accept in your portfolio. Can you talk about that trade-off between time horizon and risk constraints?
Yeah, so a real consideration when you're investing is how long you have to let the investments sit and do their thing. So if you need money in a couple of years, and let's use five as a rough break-even. If you need money within 5 years, you probably don't want to put it into some of the things that would potentially produce higher growth, because they also have the higher potential to lose money for you over a short period of time. So you wouldn't put your money into equities, into stocks, if you only had 5 years, unless you also had an extremely high risk tolerance or really good, robust backup plans. And I like to use the example of myself here. I have a pretty high risk tolerance. I am currently a renter in Toronto. I don't foresee...
How can you not buy a house? Everybody and their brother and sister are buying houses, John. What's wrong with you? How could you be a renter?
I know, and we'll probably get back to my great, great shame later. But for the moment, let's...
For those of you who don't know, I'm being totally sarcastic.
Yeah. Preet has produced a number of great videos and a really comprehensive spreadsheet on how to compare renting versus buying. And I think is on relatively the same page with as I am in terms of renting being a better deal in Toronto in 2018. But let's say, you know, I'm interested in one day buying a home, and that might come within 5 years, but I don't know for sure. Again, uncertainty. I don't know for sure if that's going to be in the next 5 years. It might come later. So because I'm not sure it is within 5 years, I'm comfortable putting my down payment fund completely in equities, because it could be longer. If an opportunity to buy a house does come up within 5 years and the markets go down, that would be bad, right? And so that's why people would say, well, if it might be within 5 years and you'd have a more normal risk tolerance, then you wouldn't do that. But I have extra sources of risk tolerance because I don't have to buy within 5 years. Like, I've been renting for a number of years. Renting is not that bad. If I have to rent for another couple of years because there's a market crash and I need to wait for a recovery, I can do that. Or I can put less down. Like if I'm saving up for 20 or 25% down on a house and an opportunity to buy one comes up at the same time that the market crashes and my down payment fund is cut, well, I can put 10 or 12% on a house and still get a house. Again, I take that loss. It feels psychologically bad. And if you're not willing to do that, then don't put a similar thing into the market. But if you have a very high risk tolerance, then that's the trade-off that you could make. And so that sort of gets into some of the factors and why for most people, if you're looking at needing the money within 5 years, you wouldn't, because, oh, what if the market's down in 5 years? You don't have as much to put down. And what if you don't have that flexibility? What if you actually need the actual amount of money? If you're going off to university, you can't put 50% down on your tuition. You actually need the full tuition amount within the next 5 years. So then in that case, you'd probably take a lot less risk because you wouldn't want to put off your university start by an extra couple of years to wait for a market recovery. And you wouldn't be able to put less down and still meet your overall goal for your life. So in that case, if you had less than 5 years, you'd start to put it into something more conservative in terms of an investment.
And we talked about one of the barriers being the amount of money people have to start with. So it's possible to start with nothing and just start with a regular automatic contribution, right? I mean, that's how I started. It sounds like that's how you started.
Yeah, pretty much nothing. You need, I believe, at different places, the amount is going to be different in terms of what you need to start. In some places, it might indeed be nothing. For TDE series, for example, you need $100 in each fund to start. Right. So if you're buying a four-fund portfolio, you need $400 to start. Again, pretty close to nothing.
Right. And so that's with the TDE series, but some of the other things where it's completely turnkey.
Some of the robo-advisors, you can start with nothing.
Right. And again, when it comes to that complexity, for someone who is on the fence and they're like, I haven't started investing, how feasible is it to go and find a financial advisor to help you when you have nothing?
It's tough to find a good one. So you can go to any local bank branch and set up that pre-authorized purchase plan for some mutual funds, as you did as a kid with your very first paycheck. Yep. But I'd bet that when you bought that mutual fund, first off, you picked it yourself out of the newspaper. So you didn't get a ton of advice on terms of which mutual fund would be best for you. You didn't get a ton of advice on your overall plan. And if you're starting off with nothing, you're probably ready to invest if you're listening to this and reading the book and think that you're ready to invest. But it's also possible that there's something that you're overlooking. Like you might not have an emergency fund yet, in which case you shouldn't be investing yet until you get that set up. Or you might have some debt that you're not really thinking about, and that should probably be paid off before you start to invest.
Is it safe to say if you carry credit card debt of any amount that you should tackle that first?
Oh, yeah. Credit card debt is almost like an emergency. Like drain your emergency fund and hit the credit card debt, you know, again, with always the caveat that personal finance is personal and there are different situations and that might lead to some bad behavior where you bail yourself out with your emergency fund and then the credit card debt comes right back. So,
okay. So what about recent graduates? So let's say you've just finished college or undergrad at university and you've got some student debt. You've got your first job, you're struggling to, you know, maybe find a place to live and cover rent and all this stuff. What's your advice to new graduates? What are the things they have to deal with in terms of overall their personal finance? Not just investing, but overall, what are the things people need to focus in on? Like keep it simple. What should people focus in on?
Well, I mean, they need to focus on getting a good foundation. So as a new grad, the first thing you need to focus on is not jumping right on the hedonic treadmill. So not immediately trying to compete with your neighbors and saying, well, I'm a grad, I deserve this. I deserve a new car. And I mean, as a new graduate myself, I did buy a brand new car for the first time rather than a used one when I finished my PhD.
Was that a good choice, John?
I think so. I mean, it's 8 years later, I still have the car. And
oh, that's good.
I thought I got a lot of value out of, you know, the pride of having a new car. And
how much longer do you think you have with that car?
I anticipate I'm going to keep that car until it's between 15 and 20 years old.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, so I mean, I spent more than I needed to buy a new car, but I mean, that was consumption spending that I didn't feel too bad about. And it didn't put me into a bad financial situation. I was saving up for years in anticipation of that car.
Okay.
So
what kind of car? I'm a car guy, so.
Oh, it's a Prius.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not you know, super gearhead car, but it's nice for a science geek who likes.
I like them. They're fun.
Yeah. I love the silence. You get to a stop sign, the engine turns off, turn the fans off, and it's just completely silent.
It is kind of weird. Yeah. Okay. So you need a strong foundation. So what does that entail?
So, I mean, that entails all the regular building blocks of personal finance, like sticking to a budget, living below your means, not just like exactly at your means, but below your means so you have some capacity to absorb shocks and unexpected increases in the cost of things, as well as to save money for your future. So paying down that student debt, getting your emergency fund going, and looking forward to what you're going to need. Now, getting invested is probably also a good thing to do, but it might not be your priority at that stage because you might have some upcoming expenses within that sort of 5 year, maybe even 10 year window that you're saving up for. Like maybe you're trying to replace your milk crates with furniture that's made out of wood and metal. You know, depending on what your lifestyle was like as a grad. And
no more inflatable couches.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there are other competing financial priorities, and that's going to be one of the other big lessons is that there's always a competing financial priority and you're going to have to decide what sort of makes sense for you. But at the same time, if you put your start for investing off too long, it gets harder and harder and harder to catch up. And so the sooner that you can get started with investing, the less of your income it's going to take to get on a good path for eventual secure retirement. And the other thing is that because investing is so different from the rest of our human experience, because there's this volatility, because things go up and down, I like to recommend that as long as you're not dealing with like really high levels of debt with really high interest rates, to invest a little. Like for $25 a month going into something like a Tangerine Fund or a RoboAdvisor, you can start to see what it's like investing, and you can live through your first market crash with a few hundred or a few thousand dollars invested. So it feels a lot more real than when you're just watching it on the TV and you don't have skin in the game. That way, when the next market crash comes around and you actually have a lot of money invested, you'll be more prepared to deal with it.
Okay. So, if I was someone who is feeling somewhat intimidated and I feel the pressure to start investing because I know that investing for the long run is good, but I don't want to spend a lot of time, I want the least amount of intimidation, what is your recommendation for someone who just wants the least amount of hassles? What is your recommendation to them?
Well, the two that I just mentioned, the Tangerine or RoboAdvisor. RoboAdvisors and Tangerine, I sort of lump into the same sort of category of basically doing most of the work for you, but you still need to come in understanding that I still put it in the DIY camp because you don't have an advisor holding your hand. You don't have someone phoning you up asking where your check is this month for your RSP contribution or whatever. It's still self-directed.
When was the last time you wrote a check? I mean, other to your landlord.
Other than to my landlord, it's been quite a while.
But do you think we're ever going to see the end of checks?
I don't know. Some of these technologies stick around for a while. I mean, I have experience working within the research arm of healthcare organizations. Mm. We still use fax machines for everything.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Huh. Didn't know that was still a thing. okay. So I want to ask you about something that you alluded to earlier, that you had varied interests, very eclectic sort of career path and education, whatnot. What kind of weird hobbies do you have? Any?
I mean, I'd like to game. I like video gaming, board gaming. I managed to get she's now 6-year-old daughter into a version of Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh yeah.
Which is awesome and fun. And if you have young kids, you can imagine how much fun this is. so, you know, we don't do like full character sheets and all the rules, but you know, we tell a story together where the characters are doing things and she decides on some parts and I decide on some parts as the dungeon master, and we roll the 20-sided dice and the other sided dice to do damage or to do skill checks. Like one of the scenarios we ran recently, we called Dumplings and Dragons because she had a little friend over and she's like, come play Dungeons and Dragons with us. And she's like, Dumplings and Dragons? What's Dumplings and Dragons? And so I was like, that's a brilliant little swap of the name and we're going to play that. And so the scenario was that they played Dumplings and Dragons. A dragon came to town and they had to make dumplings and feed it to the dragon, and they had to score against their, stamina stat in order to make the dumplings, because it's a lot of work kneading all that dough. And then they had to score against their dexterity stat to put them in the dragon's mouth and not have them get singed by the fire. And then once the dragon was full, he flew off and gave them a gift. And yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
Can I just say both? I mean, right now I'm
no. More, you gotta pick a side.
As a teenager, I was much more into Star Trek.
Good.
I have a Star Trek uniform at home.
Who doesn't?
Which I also break out for Artemis Games. But I mean, right now I'm kind of into Star Wars just because they're out in the theater now, and it's been a while since we had, well, I guess we did have a Star Wars.
Did you hear that Quentin Tarantino is going to direct a new Star Trek movie?
Yeah.
That's pretty wild, man. That's pretty wild. I'm looking forward to that. Okay. Now, as you also know, at the end of every podcast, every guest gets a minute, 2 minute, whatever. I don't care. To give themselves a commercial. So what do you want to sell?
So I've got a couple of things here to sell. The first is my book called The Value of Simple, and that's going to teach people how to become do-it-yourself investors. And it's going to walk people through step-by-step how you actually do all of this. So how are you going to open an account? How are you going to actually make those trades? And include some screenshots from various providers, because that can also be a really big barrier to getting the confidence when you read something in a book, like go make a limit order for an ETF and then have to figure out how to do it on this sort of foreign looking order screen. Actually seeing that it's not that intimidating is really helpful to get going and get started. And then also that sort of extra information that you need, like reminders to set up something in your calendar so that once a year you check in on your portfolio, because it's great to be hands off, but you don't want to be completely dead at the switch. And then also I have a course called Practical Index Investing for Canadians. It's an online course. You take it at your own pace, combination of text articles, infographics, and videos of me and screenshots again from these providers. That's the same basic material as what's in the book. So it's going to tell people how to become index investors, but it's going to be in even more depth. So in addition to talking about how you're going to make that step-by-step purchase, there's some tips at the end about how are you going to control your bad investor behavior and tune things out? What do you need to keep in mind? What are those reminders that you're going to set up? Even more information on, you know, whether you're going to use your RSP or your TFSA as your best go-to. More information on tax optimizing for the people that want to do that, as well as a fair number of warnings that getting down the rabbit hole of tax optimization adds a lot of complexity. And as the title of the book says, there's value in simplicity. So even if you pay a tiny bit more for your investments, if it's simple enough that you're able to manage it and get on with the rest of your life and actually invest, that's going to be totally worth it versus trying to go for the absolute cheapest thing like an ETF, where then you're so intimidated by the complexity, you don't end up sticking to your plan. So try to keep things simple is basically the message I'm trying to sell. And they can find that at valueofsimple.ca or course.valueofsimple.ca.
And what's the cost of the book?
So the ebook is $6.99 and the print edition is $19.99. You can find those at your usual online bookseller locations like Amazon, Kobo, Indigo. And you can also buy them directly from me on my site at valueofsimple.ca. The course is $2.99. That's $299. And you can find it at course.valueofsimple.ca.
Excellent. And my last question for you is, if you had to estimate the percentage of people who should be doing it themselves to some extent, what do you think that percentage is?
Well, I think it's quite high. There are some people that are going to be well suited to getting full service advice, particularly the people with large assets who are going to get real value for what they're paying, because they won't be paying, you know, 2.5% and not getting a plan out of it. They'll be paying more like 1.5% for their investments, and then getting someone who's really going to hold their hand and really provide that level of planning for them. For most of the rest of the people, they're probably going to be better off doing it themselves for the investment management part. And when they need planning, actually paying for a plan separate with a fee-for-service planner.
Do you want to quickly make the distinction between investing and planning?
Oh, yeah. I can't, like, we could have talked the whole podcast about this, and I can't believe we haven't.
I've covered it in other podcasts, so yeah. It's no big deal. But
so planning is an important part that gets really short shrift in sort of the public's consciousness and the advertising from the banks and whatnot, because understanding where you're going, what the trade-offs are that you're making in your plan, what you're going to have in retirement, and what the risk is that you'll have a little bit more, a little bit less, is really important and really key in getting confidence over your money and having a good relationship with your money, and then being able to use your money to meet your actual life goals rather than just like arbitrary financial goals. Whereas investing is the process of just putting the money into investments, which is then going to help meet the objectives of the plan. And the investing part, it's very difficult to add value, to do something that's going to return more than you would get in this sort of simple index investing method that I talk about, and that Preet's talked about in a large number of other shows and platforms and whatnot.
That would be me.
Yeah. And lots of other people make the same point, which is that active investing, trying to pay someone to do something much fancier than that, doesn't really return the value that you're paying in terms of the fees. So try to minimize the fees on your investments and then pay for the plan. The problem is that for most people, the way they get planning is by going to someone who sells them investments. And so they combine the notion of getting their money invested with the notion of getting a plan. But really, you can get a plan separately. If you're in debt at the moment and you need a plan to help get out, just because someone who sells investments won't help you create a plan because they can't sell you investments until you're already out of the debt, doesn't mean that you can't go and find a financial planner who will help you create that plan to help first get out of the debt and then start saving and moving towards your goals. It's just you have to pay for the plan separately.
All right. Well, I think we'll end it there. We've covered a lot of ground. Hopefully listeners who are on the fence, and I get a lot of questions about people who want more information about, you know, how do I get started? There's a huge variation, I think, in terms of the comfort level of listeners in terms of investing, financial planning, and the various topics that we talk about. And I especially wanted to talk to people who were more on the lower confidence side. And I think there are a lot of people who could do this. They just don't know how and where to start, and they just need a little bit of a helping hand. So if you think you're in that category, think about visiting John's site and take a look at his book and his course. I know it gets glowing recommendations from people in the personal finance community. Very highly respected person that we're talking to here on the podcast. So John, thanks very much for coming on the show. And to all the faithful listeners, thank you for listening to the show, and we will talk to you next time.